The Lord be with you.
And also with you. This
will be a sermon on the Ten Commandments. I know, just try to contain your excitement. I won't deny that rules are boring. But the Ten Commandments aren't boring if we understand their context. The commandments don't emerge from history as these universal principles. The living God gifts them to Israel within the context of a covenant relationship, within the ongoing drama of liberation. A couple weeks ago, the preaching team read this Exodus 20 text. And Chris Klein, our minister of congregational life, invited the group to see the text through a psychological lens. In psychology, there's something called Stockholm syndrome. Stockholm syndrome is a condition that causes hostages to develop an alliance with their captors as a survival strategy during captivity. This is one reason why those who experience abuse may return to their abusers. Even before the Israelites cross the Red Sea, they say this to Moses: "Let us alone, and let us serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And that attitude becomes a sort of refrain for the Israelites. Life as slaves in Egypt was better than life out here. This boundless country, this new freedom, this wilderness isn't everything we hoped it would be. Then God spoke these words: "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." As an enslaved people, the Israelites have been shaped from generation to generation. Their minds and their bodies have been conditioned to be slaves. They don't know how to be free. They don't know how to live as a free people. They know how to survive in that house of slavery, but they don't know how to thrive in God's freedom. So it's not surprising that the Israelites begin to relate to God as they related to their Egyptian oppressors. They distrust God's provision. They bicker and complain behind God's back, as a slave might against their taskmasters. They fear God's power in the same way they fear Pharaoh's power. They have only known the power of an oppressive sovereign, so they can hardly begin to imagine the power of a holy God. They can't begin to imagine a holy reverence for that loving Lord who sets free and sustains. So even before they leave Mount Sinai, they rebel against God. These Ten Commandments and the whole wilderness journey are about the Lord teaching the Israelites how to be free, how to trust, how not to be afraid. The Lord is saying to the Israelites, "Yes, I will be your sovereign, but I'm nothing like the sovereign you knew in Egypt. I'm nothing like that Pharaoh. Pharaoh kept you in slavery, but I delivered you. Pharaoh may have let you survive as slaves, but I will show you what it is to thrive and to be free as my beloved children." So will the Israelites replay the story in which they've been formed as oppressed slaves under an oppressive king? Will they carry that distorted relationship from Egypt into the promised land? Will they know true rest or only ceaseless work? The Israelites must be reformed. Their enslaved bodies and their captive imaginations must be retrained and disciplined so they can know how to be free. They need God's commandments to inhabit a new way of life. I was in Detroit this past week for the Christian Community Development Association conference, and I shared a hotel room with Pastor Sam Moffitt. Pastor Sam is the pastor of House of God Family Life Ministries, and his congregation is a partner, along with COS, in the Camelot Community Partnership. We're a group of congregations in this neighborhood that are seeking the flourishing of those who live here. And I was telling Pastor Sam about the sermon I would preach today on Exodus 20. And during the course of our conversation, Pastor Sam said, "The Exodus was about the Lord getting the Israelites out of Egypt. But the wilderness is about the Lord getting Egypt out of the Israelites." I think Pastor Sam is exactly right. We all carry our past with us. And the broken parts of our stories are not easy to leave behind. Those broken parts of our stories can keep us from the liberation which God has earned for us. And that's true for each of us in different ways, depending on our story. But it's clearly true for the Israelites. So God goes about this work of reshaping them in light of their broken past. And God is giving them a new narrative, a new story to live into, a new identity, a new way of life, a new structure within which to live, a new home, a house of freedom. The Ten Commandments constitute the outer walls of this house of freedom, or the house frame, if you will. Now, some may find the house to be restrictive, but if we step inside this house, if we agree to its boundaries, we're surprised to find that this house is far more expansive than we could have imagined, far more large inside than it looked like from the outside. And within these walls, true freedom becomes possible. Liberation from our broken past becomes possible. As Terence Fretheim says, the commandments open up life rather than close it down. I imagine most of us can pretty easily think of someone who was raised in a very strict home and then went on to rebel against that upbringing. Maybe that person is you. That's why you're at COS, such a rebellious congregation. But it's true that harsh rules without warm, loving relationship can incite rebellion. Commandments, laws, rules. These words don't exactly inspire feelings of freedom and joy and abundant life. But the Ten Commandments are not just a new form of bondage under a new Pharaoh. They are gifts of God. John Calvin claimed that the law is not given to make us afraid of God, but to provide a means of loving Him who is our deliverer and the source of our freedom. I like the way Karl Barth puts it. It was in an act of liberation that the high God made himself the God of this people. And it is liberation that he wills from this people in his commandments. God gives the commandments for the sake of freedom. We got to talk about that word, freedom. It's a tricky word, especially in this context, in this country. I think so many of us live in an illusion of what freedom really is. We tend to think of freedom as the complete restraint, complete absence of restraint. The individual liberty to do whatever we please, to say yes or no to whatever we would like. Don't tread on me. Don't tell me how to live. But this sort of freedom doesn't work so well out in the wilderness, in a landscape that's shaped by temptation and sin and violence and hostility. This illusion of freedom leads us to idolize our personal rights. It creates the possibility for the massacre in Las Vegas this past week. It too easily forgets that we've all been shaped by sin, that we've all been living in a house of slavery, and opening the front door to the wilderness of restraint leads only to fear, distrust, bickering, and violence. We live in an illusion of freedom. When I was engaged to Jana, my wife, some of my friends would say things like, "Oh, now you've got a ball and chain, Andrew." And I remember thinking, "What? Are you serious? It seems ridiculous." As if marriage were this constraining and oppressive experience that men simply endure for the sake of the human race and the good of society. I felt like I was getting away with something by marrying Jana, right? I worried when she would realize she was way out of my league. But there's security and there's freedom in covenant relationship. Being uncommitted doesn't make us more free. One of my classmates in seminary was from Zambia. And he shared with me about his first experience shopping in Meijer. And he said, "Andrew, I felt overwhelmed. And when I walked down the cereal aisle, I was frozen. There were so many choices. How do you live with so many choices?" Having infinite choices doesn't make us free. This May, our own Todd Chaffee was speaking to the group of resident pastors who gathered for a reunion here. And as a college professor, Todd spends a lot of his time advising emerging adults. And he told us that he advises some brilliant and bright young people. But he says, "Many of them come to me feeling overwhelmed, feeling uncertain as they approach graduation, because they have so many paths open to them. Having more and more options doesn't make us more free." We live in an illusion of freedom. We think we're in a wide open country, but in reality, it's a wilderness out there. And we haven't fully left behind that house of slavery. It still haunts us. In the film The Matrix, the character Morpheus is a liberator of sorts. And Neo is a captive, a slave in a virtual world. And Morpheus says to Neo, "You are a slave. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, into a prison that you cannot see or taste or touch, a prison for your mind." St. Paul says, "We are slaves of sin." We all know life in that decrepit house of slavery, and some of us know it better than others. We all know the dingy room of guilt, with its stale, musty smell, We all know the tiny room of shame, whose drapes are always closed, where light never gets in. We all know the room of legalism with its cold floors and its hard-backed furniture. And we know the dark closet of fear. And we don't always talk about other parts of the house. The basement with the broken stairwell of racism from which our black and brown sisters and brothers struggle to emerge. That forgotten attic of criminal injustice, where incarcerated men and women are forgotten by society. The kitchen of broken food systems, with a door handle that's out of reach for so many in our world. We all know that house of bondage. It's part of our broken story, and we are often pulled back into its cramped rooms and its dim light. But it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. So much of the Christian life is about learning to be free, truly free, not a freedom from restraint, not the freedom to do whatever we please, not the freedom for a privileged few in our society. True freedom, freedom from guilt and shame, freedom from legalism and fear, freedom from racism and inequality, injustice and poverty. True freedom, the freedom to always say yes to loving God and our neighbor, to rejoice with our neighbor, even when our life is full of grief, and to grieve with our neighbor, even when our life is full of joy. The freedom to seek justice always, to love mercy always, and to walk humbly with God always. That's life in God's house of freedom. And it's a freedom we can't manufacture, we can't construct on our own. We can't build it with our power and our privilege and our independence. God is the architect and the master builder of that house. And unless the Lord builds the house, the laborers labor in vain. Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish, but to fulfill." Put differently, do not think that I have come to demolish the house my Father built. I have come not to demolish, but to furnish. It wasn't that the law was inadequate. We were inadequate to obey it, to get beyond the legalism that we see so clearly in the Pharisees, and to discover the heart of God's law. Jesus comes to fulfill the law for us and to furnish the Father's house with love. Law and love are not at odds, friends. They go together. So when the New Testament is critical of the law as a way to salvation, such critique isn't aimed at the Old Testament law itself, but at the way in which it was abused and idolized by the Pharisees and others in first century Judaism. No, Jesus doesn't come to knock down the walls his Father built. Jesus comes to strip down the musty wallpaper of guilt, to pull down the dark the shades of shame, and to let the light pour in, to throw out that straight-backed furniture of legalism and to move in a plush couch of joyful obedience. To hang loud, colorful art on the walls, he stokes a cozy fire in the fireplace, and he sets a large table with the richest of foods and the choicest wine. Friends, there's life in that house. There's life in that house. Jesus puts on a record that just makes you want to sway. There's life in that house. There's freedom in that house. There's love in that house. And Christ is inviting us to move in, to settle down, to be at home, to taste his lavish love at his table. And when we know Christ's love, the frame of that house isn't restrictive, it's protective. The Ten Commandments create that safe boundary within which we can dwell with God and our neighbor in ways of love and justice. It's a space where Jesus dwells. Jesus doesn't want us to remain in the foyer, looking back out the door at that old house of slavery, or longingly into the wilderness. Jesus invites us to come deeper into the house, to come into the inner rooms, to discover the deeper purpose and spirit of the law, which was always to delight in the one who loves us and has set us free. In the Gospel of John, Jesus says, "The slave does not have a permanent place in the household. The Son has a place there forever. So if the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed." This house of freedom is our Father's house. It's a house with many rooms, and the Son lives there. And he goes there to prepare a place for us, so that where he dwells, we also may dwell. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.